Showers may return later on Saturday with a high in the upper 60s. This is meteorologist Tony Salimo from the WTBQ Weather Center.
The opinions expressed in this program reflect only those of the participants and are not necessarily those of the sponsors, management, or staff of WTBQ Radio or FST Broadcasting Corporation.
WTBQ. Hello and welcome to Marriage Conversation. This is the show that happens the first Thursday here of each month with Dr. Stephen Frew, who is a marriage coach, lives out in California, and joins us, as I said, the first Thursday of each month and lets us know about marriage. He is a marriage coach and an author. He has written two books, With These Rings and From Marginal to Magnificent. He is terrific. He knows what he's talking about, and you can talk with us if you want. You can call 845-651-1110 and talk about your marriage and share your thoughts. And today we are going to talk about team building, how to partner as a team in your marriage. And I want to welcome Dr. Frew to his show, Marriage Conversation, here on WTBQ. And welcome, Dr. Frew. How are you today?
Hi, Shannon. I'm good.
You're good. Good is good.
What else to say there? I'm good.
That's good. Good is really good. How is California doing?
Well, we've had a 6-week heat wave. That's been wearing everybody out, but this week it's dropped down into the high 80s, we're all kind of relieved with that. And, of course, it's October, and we'll get a couple more weeks, but then we'll be into cooler weather. But it's been a little tough out here.
Yeah, no, that can be tough. Heat is just really tough. I don't like it. It really does fray the nerves. Does it fray the marriages, too?
Yeah, I think what happens in a lot of homes, they're running the air conditioning all the time, so whoever is the financially anxious person in a relationship, and every relationship seems to have one person who's financially anxious, the financially anxious person gets kind of out of sorts because they're just burning through big electric bills. But I also think that it kind of forces a lot more indoor time, which always isn't, a lot of times isn't really a desirable thing because people get on each other's nerves. So, you know, when the temperature outside is 100 or 110, people stay indoors and watch TV and get in each other's way and get short. I think it puts a big stress on families.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Interesting that you say that there's one person that's financially anxious. And that's probably really true. I never thought about that. Probably sometimes on different things. One can be financially anxious on the heat, the air conditioning, that sort of stuff, and maybe be penny wise and dollar foolish because they can care about the little things and not the big things, I find. Is money a real key issue in relationships?
It absolutely is, because it's the kind of the readout of other things that go on behind the scenes. It's what you can see and talk about. So I can easily, be critical of my wife because she bought presents for the grandchildren. When I do something similar, I can forgive myself because I'm just being generous. So, we have to remember that, we picked each other, and pretty much who you picked hasn't changed in 5 years, 10 years, or 20 years. They are who they were then, and of course everybody is growing and emerging. I don't mean to say that they're not, but the core stuff, is pretty solid. And in our background, for example, I was raised in the streets of New Jersey and very poor. She was raised in Connecticut and with an attorney father, so she came up with a whole different kind of framework about money and solving money problems and vacations and stuff. I came up with no vacations and sometimes worrying whether we're even going to eat. So bringing that kind of history into a relationship then makes it just fair game for projecting all your worst fears on the other person. For her, it might be projecting onto me that I'm a tightwad and I can't, I don't want to ever give the grandchildren presents, for example. For me, it might be, she's just a sieve and about money, and she'll just spend it, whatever's there. If there's another $100 laying on the counter, let's spend it quick. Now, neither of those projections are true. She's responsible about money. I'm not, a totally ungenerous person. So we then go to, this is what today's program is about, really, building a team. We go to, you know, what do you observe for and what do I observe for, and how can we bring that together into a conversation that will make this a better family?
So what you're saying here is how you were programmed, how you were raised really matters, and we have to take that into account.
Yes.
So I think that that's a real key issue, because I often feel that people think they ended up, they got to this, from the same place, you know, that they had the same starting point, and they didn't have the same starting point. Yes, it was the same marriage. Yes, you know, all that, you know, this is the person you married, but you really do come from different backgrounds. Even if they seem similar, they're very different. So we have to take that into account. How much should that be taken into account, and how much should that be wiped clean and just say, this is where we start as our team?
Well, there are people, it's interesting, I talked to a couple the other day that was going to a psychologist out here in Westlake, and he said, the psychologist said to them, look, I don't care a hoot about your parents and family and history. He said, what I care about is what you're doing today. He calls himself a behaviorist, and he says he starts in the present, and he thinks it's a waste of time to deal with the past at all. Now, that's a field in psychology, and it's a legitimate field, and people say, look, forget who your mother was, your father was. You got a problem with your spouse, let's see what we can do, what new behaviors we can help you create that'll make it better. Now, you know, that part, that in my history and judgment, that partially works, but I'm so much hungrier than that. Sometimes that approach will seem shallow and incomplete to me. So that would be a big conversation, because if we had one of those, and we should sometime this year, have one of those people with that point of view on the phone with us on the show, then we could hear their point of view, and they could say it more articulately than I can say it. I believe that my mother and my father educated me, gave me several PhDs on several important areas of life. They educated me on how I should feel about my body. They educated me on how I should feel about money. They educated me on how I should feel about fun. They educated me how I should feel about siblings, and so on. I could keep going. They were giving an education when they didn't know they were giving an education, by a raised eyebrow here or a silence there. They were educating. All of us have that. We have an education from our mother and father and our siblings, and then next level school teachers, rabbi, priest, pastor, neighbors, friends. There's a bunch of influencers back there at the time of our life when we were most vulnerable, you might say, to learning. Because a child at 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 is not a critical thinker. That child is just absorbing their environment and dealing with it. So you learn some stuff. It's very hard to unlearn when you're 45.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the family thing works for me. A lot of the work I do, the coaching I do, helping people to unlearn some patterns at the same time they're creating new ones.
So it's really, I think, and I agree with you, I think it's hard to have a partnership without looking at the things that make you tick. And these things that make you tick certainly come up in a relationship more so than, let's say, at work or something, because it's not the same sort of atmosphere. But when you're home and you're having a family, certainly once you have children, a lot of people go back to the way they were raised on certain things. You know, this is the way we expect to do it. And they just follow patterns that they learned and they've never thought twice about. So I think that your past does come in there, especially in a family relationship. But so what should you focus on when you want to be a team and you want to build a with your partner and your family? What should you focus on, and where you're going, where you came from, or where you are now?
Well, an excellent framing of it. Here's a way to think. You know, I have a leadership business, do a lot of leadership consulting, and I call it leadership from the inside out. That is to say, if you really want to improve your leadership effectiveness in your business or even in your family, you have to go inward. You have to find out what's in your way, what you've learned, what doesn't work for you that you keep on using anyway, what kind of habits and patterns and so forth. In this conversation, I think you kind of start on the outside and go in. You start with taking an assessment of where you are. And if you want to create a viable, lively, stimulating, productive, effective family environment that we're talking about today kind of as a team, then what you have to do is you start looking at where you are, what is in your way. Now, one way to do that, to get your hands around it, because if I say that, everybody who's listening is going to say, yeah, so what? So I say, well, here's one way to look at it. I have a father and I have a grandfather. I have a couple grandfathers, right? They're gone now, but they're still in me. I have a father and a grandfather, another grandfather and grandmother and great-grandmother and so on. I have a Swiss heritage and I have a Swedish heritage on my mother's side. So if I start with looking at what were the values that my father brought into the family, believed in, without really talking about them. What were the ones he just inhabit in every day showing up at the table? For example, I'll give you a couple examples. What values did he bring? What did he teach me when I was too little to even think or criticize or be critical of it? Well, one value he brought to was a very conservative Christian point of view. At the table, he bowed his head and prayed at the beginning of the meal. He didn't say, is it okay with everybody if I pray? He didn't say, gee, I just want to explain to you a minute, it's okay with me if you're a different religion. What he did is just bowed his head and prayed. So that I was learning very small that he had something going on there. I didn't know exactly what it was, of course. I just knew that he was praying. I didn't know who this person he was praying to was. I didn't understand. Is God a person up in the sky? Is God next door neighbor? I didn't understand. I was a little kid. But I knew he was doing it. Now, there were other things. He had a work ethic. So when he had a terrible head cold or the flu or whatever, he was the milkman. He got out of bed at 3 in the morning. It didn't matter how sick he was. He got out of bed, dressed, coughing, stumbling, feverish, went to work anyway. I never saw him miss a day work. And so he taught his three sons that in one way, you could say as an adult, wow, nice value. He had a good work ethic. Another way he taught us to be stupid, that you would say, I don't, it's not important that I take care of my own health or that I'm limited or that I get to take a day or two of resting or whatever. There were other values he had. So when I start looking at my own family, I say to myself, how do those values influence how I relate to my daughter, so I can get a nice connection. For example, she was sick last week one day, and I can feel my father coming to me in his spirit and saying, you know, well, she's not that sick, and she should go to school. That's what you should do. So if I know that, I can start to look at how I'm functioning as a team, because instead of just going on automatic pilot with my father's attitude, I will say out loud, well, what do you think? Do you think it's a day that you should miss school? Do you think it's a day you should go to school? What do you think? Now, we've always treated all our children that way, and our children have very, very high attendance records. But we've just, so maybe the values come out the same because they never were pressured to go to school. They just got to choose. And since they got to choose, they never had to resent or resist school. They could just say, well, you know, I'm sick and I'm not going today. And everybody say, okay, it's good, cool, fine.
So this is how teams play out the everyday living. Let's say you have someone who was raised like you that said, you're going to school, I don't care how sick you are, and a wife that says, absolutely not, I will let her stay home at the slightest hint of a cold. So if you're at opposing sides on something small and everyday like this, and this causes a big fight, that is not teamwork, obviously, right?
Well, that's it. That's the, if you're talking to a coach, then that is a good place to start, because what we can do there is say to the wife, okay, tell me why this is so important to you. Tell me about your background, your history, and tell me about your history with illness and why it's so important to you that if she sniffles a little bit to keep her home from school. So let's pretend that it's not good and it's not bad. Let's just pretend for a moment it just is, and tell us why it's so important. She'll start to talk about her family and her history and her values. Now, if he can listen, he'll learn from her. He'll learn about her.
Mm-hmm.
He'll learn he'll learn about her fears. He'll learn about things that happened in her life. So they'll become more intimate, which is kind of what we want. Now, if we do the same with him, why are you so adamant? And he starts saying, you know, well, I had a friend and their parents let them stay home whenever they want, and they turned out to be drunks and drug addicts. He has some fear and some stuff like that. If he can just talk about it, she'll start to learn where he's coming from. And if she does do that, they'll have some intimacy. So the number one rule about that is to be curious about each other and not to be positional, not to be judgmental, not to be, you know, lecturing, but to be curious. Tell me why this is important and how it's important to you.
Well, that takes communication, and that takes someone willing to listen to the other as opposed to just, you know, espouse their feelings and their view, and that's the way it goes. So when you're a partnership, you have to have great communication, and you have to respect the other's point of view and maybe compromise somewhere in between, right?
I think that great communication is a great expression there. I think you're always creating communication so that compromise doesn't mean what it usually means, where I just give in. It means that, for me, compromise really happens when I listen carefully to who my wife is. And that will automatically bring us closer together. What happens when we don't compromise is we don't listen at all. We take positions. I call that positional leadership. It's like saying I'm the CEO and it's my way or the highway. It's an old model of leadership. If we do that, we can be sure we won't communicate. If instead of that, I say, well, Shannon, tell me why it's so important, and you start from your heart telling me why it's so important to how you treat your daughter, then I start to get a feeling of what? Empathy. I start to go, oh, I understand something different about Shannon than I did 10 minutes ago. Oh. And then if you turn that around and say, Stephen, why is this so important? And I start telling you, then, yes, that creates good communication, because instead of being positional, we're being curious and we're genuinely looking to hear and understand what the other person's point of view, which automatically we're not so far apart as we thought.
Mm. That takes a little calming down. That takes a little of the not needing to be right. Because I can think of friends that I know that are constantly fighting on small things like this continually. Wow, he's this way, she's this way. You know, that sort of thing that constantly makes them angry at each other so they don't listen. Oh, I don't care what your father was like. This is the way it's supposed to be. You know, you know better than I, certainly, that contention that happens and these small things build. Is it okay to tell the kids something like, you know, your father really wants you to go to school because that's the way he was raised, and, you know, it's hard to change him, and maybe he has a point. I think that you should stay home, and as you do with your children, could you say it's really your choice depending on how you feel and how you think you can function throughout the day?
I would agree with all of it, except if the father's off at work or in the military or something, then you're going to have to speak for him. But the best thing to have happen is the father speak for himself by phone if he has to or whatever, and say, look, here's my values and here's what I think should happen. Because for me, it goes right to, I've been thinking so much about teams, and I just did a big workshop with a whole bunch of real estate people the other day, and we were talking about how to build a highly productive team, and they were talking as if they didn't really get a lot of help on how to build a team, and yet their whole business is built on teamwork in that particular office. They're co-owners, and there's about 50 of them, I think, and they need to have healthy teamwork. So we're talking about, well, we don't talk enough about how this can happen or what should happen here, but if the father, for example, gets talking to a child and talks about his values and his past and why it's important to him, the child, I think, will process that. Maybe they won't do exactly as the father wants them to do, but the father often says, look, you know, I knew somebody whose parents never went to school or never wanted him to go to school or whatever, and he knows failure stories. He's out there in that kind of world in business, and he knows failure stories. So he's a little bit nervous and anxious about his children being failures, and so he might push him a little harder than the mother might push him in that particular instance. And it's the same thing, kind of like the thing I talk about playing hurt in sports. A good coach doesn't ask his player who is genuinely hurt to go back on the field because he might seriously injure that youngster. But there is a time when, and I've talked to lots of coaches about this because this is my conversation, and coaches have said, yeah, you have to understand something, Stephen. It's not that simple. He said, Of course I wouldn't send a young man back on the field or a young woman on the field if they were seriously hurt. However, there is a time and a place for saying, you know, Joyce, yeah, I know you sprained your thing a little bit, but I want you to go back and play. And there's a thing of working through something that gives the child additional confidence and additional stamina and additional fortitude, maybe, so that a good coach knows the difference between those. And I think a good parent does, too.
Well, that's an interesting analogy there, because a lot of kids, my daughter included, are on teams. And we have these conversations a lot. Are coaches too tough? They do not coddle the kids like we do. We recently had an incident with my daughter's coach, and she goes way too far, makes kids cry on a daily basis, you know, yes. Beats them up, says they're rotten, says they're mean. You know, I mean, this is not a thing you can do to children. But there's a fine line between saying your parents might say that you're terrific when you're not because they love you unconditionally, but I won't. If you're lousy, I'm going to tell you you're lousy. And there's this whole feeling, I guess a whole sort of thought now that people, parents, teachers, people around children are constantly telling them they're good, but not necessarily telling them what they're good for. They're just good for everything all the time. And that this is not a great thing.
Helicopter parents.
Helicopter parents, yes. And they hover. That's why the name helicopter parents. But aside from just hovering, I mean, every kid has to have a medal on the team, especially when they're little. You know, you don't just give it to the kid that does the best. Everybody gets a medal. When we were kids, if you weren't good, you didn't get anything. You just can't leave anyone out. Is that detrimental in your professional opinion?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think anything that's phony is detrimental to children. Mm. There's a psychologist years ago, Brutal Bettelheim. He believed that the violence in fairy tales was bad for children. So he had a bunch of fairy tales rewritten to take out the violence in them. And what he found out, this was at a big mental hospital in New York, Bellevue maybe, he did this experiment, and what he found out was the children that were healthier were the ones who read the fairy tales with the violence in them. And what he said was, look, violence is part of life. We can't keep our children from it. They've got to learn how to cope with it and deal with it. It's out there. Bad people are out there. Violence is out there. Unfairness is out there. Rewards are out there. The world runs that way. If you and I both go to work for a company and you're just a working machine, and you show up 15 minutes early in the morning and you stay a little later and you're always, all your stuff is always done and I'm kind of laid back, you're the one that's going to get the promo, all things being equal, not me. That's the way the world works. So you're saying to your children, I mean, my daughter in soccer a few weeks ago, the coach on the other side was a mean, awful coach. We all agreed she was a mean, awful coach. But the children playing on her team were also, a number of them were mean and were saying mean things. And what we elected to do, her mother and I, is say, you go right back out there. And you learn how to armor yourself against that, because they don't really know you and they're not talking about you. They're just talking.
Right.
So she had to learn and did it. And she came back and she said, you know, I just let it go. It's not about me. And so, you know, in the world, you have to learn some of those things that aren't easy to learn. And I think that's what you're alluding to right now.
Well, hopefully in a marriage, it's not like a soccer field. Hopefully we're not being mean to each other and that we have to learn how to deal with it. But certainly there's a lot of issues. And when it comes to being a team, most people feel that that takes out the sort of romance of a marriage and that takes out all the good stuff. Well, we're going to talk about that when we come back. We have to take a quick break now. But when we come back, we're going to talk about how your marriage can be a great team. We are talking here with Dr. Stephen Frew on his show, Marriage Conversation. And we'll be back in just a few here on WTBQ.
WTBQ.
Hello, and welcome back to Marriage Conversation. This is the show that happens here the first Thursday of each month from 12 noon to 1 o'clock with Dr. Stephen Frew. Dr. Frew is a marriage coach and an author of two books on marriage, With These Rings and From Marginal to Magnificent. And he is here to talk to us about marriage, answer your questions about marriage. You can join in the conversation with us at 845-651-1110 and ask Dr. Frew a question. And today we are talking about how to be a partner in your marriage, how to be a team, more than just a love affair. You need to make a team, especially when you start having children. It is a team and a family. And before we took a break, Dr. Frew, I mentioned that some people might think that being a team and being a partner is really unromantic and that this all should be about romance. But marriage can't be about romance all the time, can it?
Well, yeah, that question about romance really triggers a bunch of stuff, I think. You know, if you think about vision, what each of you, when you got married, each of us, when we got married, when we walked down the aisle or walked in and joined at the altar, whatever it was, we all brought a vision. We brought a vision. Now, you may not have spelled out that vision, but you had a vision of what your marriage, would look like and how it would evolve over time. You could picture 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years. You had a vision. And if I came up to you and say, well, what's this marriage going to look like? What do you think it's going to look like in 20 years? And you're whatever age you are and you're marrying, maybe it's your second marriage or whatever. You say, well, I'm never going to do that again. But this is what, you know, this person is so, and they listen and blah, blah. We could spell it out. Now, that vision, you have to remember, is your vision. Your partner also had a vision, and they necessarily didn't match. They seemed to match when you get married because the hormones were strong, but they didn't necessarily match. And so one of the jobs you have in a marriage over time is to try to get clear about what vision you have for yourself as a married person, as a wife or as a husband, as a partner. Now, where romance comes in is with vision, because what's romantic is if my vision for relationship is actually being related to, is actually being articulated, is actually being heard. If I think, wow, I've always wanted a marriage where, and whatever you put in there, you know, I've always wanted a marriage, for example, where my wife on a given evening, when I'm out in the living room reading, she would come and sit down on the couch by me and say, what are you reading, honey? And I would say, whoa, I'm reading this thing. It's really interesting to me. And we would start talking. That's a romantic image for me. She has her own images of what it would be like if her vision for marriage was really being met. Out of that comes a sense of romance, because what's romance? It's excitement about the other person. It's feeling the warming up like a glass of cognac from the inside of you out. You start to warm up towards each other and go, you know, you're really special. You're really wonderful. You really hear me. You really pay attention to me. You really cherish me. So romance, you got to remember, in the American culture, romance is pretty dumbed down. I mean, you got psychologists saying, well, you got to have a date night. And you got somebody else saying, well, you got to take Viagra. And on and on. You got people who just are dumber than the post talking about what adults should be doing with each other. Now, those things aren't bad. Having a date night's not bad. It's fine. But it isn't a solution either. And Viagra isn't a solution. It's a tool. It's a crutch. It's a something. But it doesn't cure anything. It doesn't make anything, like the pictures in the sports pages of, you know, the young blonde woman looking totally sexually and turned on because he took Viagra. That's baloney. That's crap. That's junk. Throw it away. So what does happen, though, is when I am curious about her, or when she's curious about me, and when I know how I envision a relationship and I can talk about it, and when she knows how she envisions a relationship, so then we start to create a shared vision. Our individual vision becomes shared, and that's a process that takes over, goes on through life. How that's related to a team is it's very, very close to a sporting team, if you think about it. If you have a bunch of people wanting to play football on Friday night, high school football, their coach is going to be talking about a vision for each of them and how that comes together in all of them, how that will manifest itself that night on the field. That's what he's doing. He's saying that, look, there's a lot of competencies you need, and I'll teach you them, but vision is the emotion that's going to drive your effort and your focus and your celebration.
That sounds ideal, but what about all those people that I can just hear that are listening to us and saying, we used to have a vision, but now it's so different. It didn't turn out the way I wanted it to. You know, 10, 15, 20, 8, whatever it is, years ago, I thought we would be blah, 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 and it's not. We're still struggling. He didn't turn out to be exactly what I want, or she didn't turn out to be. How do you change that vision? How do you reprint that vision and view it differently the way it's turned out? Do we just walk away? What if we're so different in our vision? Is that salvageable?
Well, I think that really what that comes down to is the couple never learned to talk to each other.
Mm.
And they are blaming it on something else. But if they're sitting in my office or we're doing a Skype interview, and by the way, I do Skype calls, so couples that are listening that wants to, I have couples all over the place, got one in England, that we Skype regularly, and we just talk about these things together. So you can do it by phone, you can do it by Skype, you can do it here. If I'm coaching that couple, I'm saying, look, the first thing is to not tell me what you don't have anymore, but I want to tell you what you didn't learn and see if we can help you learn some new competencies so that you can create a vision now. Not what you don't have, but what you do have. Because I can guarantee you, I absolutely guarantee you, or you won't spend a dime with me. If you can't spend 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 hours with me on the phone or on Skype, if you don't have a vision, a beginning of a vision, then you don't spend any money with me, because I believe every couple that's willing already has it there. They just don't have the competency to reveal it, to get it out there.
But what if their vision is outside of themselves? What if they feel that our vision was we were supposed to have a successful business and it fell apart 3 years ago, or, you know, he got fired from that great job and now our vision is entirely different? What if they feel it is outside of their marriage, that vision, and they're just upset with the other one for maybe failing or not protecting that vision somehow or whatever? I mean, what if they feel that, you know, the other one is so to blame for the lack of the vision? Is that, I mean, can they still get a vision back together? I mean, how, you know, if you're not going to talk to them, slowly.
Absolutely. Sports teams face this all the time. Out here we have the University of Southern California. They had a vision of going undefeated this year because their quarterback came back, and he's supposedly a Heisman Trophy level quarterback. In the second game, the Stanford Cardinals beat them, and the quarterback threw a couple interceptions. Now, that crushed their vision, or it didn't crush their vision, and it turns out what I've been reading in the sports pages, it didn't crush their vision, because they're saying we still have a vision. We're looking at the realities of what we did and didn't do, and we made some mistakes and da 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 da, and we have, here's what we're doing, and we're going to all pull together and do it. So in a unsuccessful sports team, they would all put their head down and all say, well, I guess that's our season. But in a successful sports team, what they'll say is, what did we learn from that, and what can we do now that will truly look like what we share together? What's going to happen here that all of us can buy into and say, let's go? Now, to have a shared vision, you have to have the competency of embracing conflict. You have to be willing, and you have to know how to embrace conflict, because this isn't Disneyland out there, folks. It's a man and a woman, and they're trying to talk about some difficult stuff that's difficult to talk about, and a lot of times it isn't easy. That's why you need a coach. That's why you need somebody to help you, so that you can say, wait, I'm lost here. Right. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say here. And that's the function of that person, is to help you and to guide you through it.
So we do need a leader. We need someone outside of ourselves. I mean, you know, so if someone's listening, they really can't do this alone, or they certainly need to, if they picked a team leader, does it have to be one of them, or should it be someone outside the marriage?
Well, another good question, because some people some couples, of course, don't need anybody outside the marriage to help them. They do it quite well. Thank you very much. And I'm always happy to meet those couples. I've met a bunch of them, and they say, you know, Stephen, we really, and I say, good. I'm glad. I celebrate that. Now, those that do, though, they have to learn a couple of things. What I talk about competencies. Sometimes one person is what we call in leadership, and sometimes the other person is in leadership. So they have to learn how to trust. I have to learn how to trust when my partner is in leadership and I'm listening, and she's saying, here's what our vision for this marriage, and here's what I think needs to happen, and, you know, the grandchildren are coming Friday night, and here's how I expect that will unfold, and here's what I need from you, here's what I'd like to see happen. She's talking about her vision for the larger family, and she's leading. I'm following, and I'm really kind of saying, yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am. I'm trusting her. Mm-hmm. Other times, I'm leading, and she's saying, okay, I got that. And I'm saying, look, we need to have just you and me in Zuri and not have anybody over this Friday night. It's just us. And she's saying, okay, I got it, you know, and this has happened, that's happened, let's do this. So, and that goes to money, of course. It goes to vacations, of course. It goes to house remodeling. It goes all over the place because leadership is always shifting depending on who is observing for what needs to happen.
Mm, that's an interesting point. Leadership is always shifting. So depending on who has that expertise in that particular area, who feels stronger, who knows that can lead in this particular area where somebody can lead in another area. And that's about knowing your spouse and knowing your marriage. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to elaborate on that and why a team is important for your marriage. It really is. We are talking about your marriage and partnership today. So stay where you are. And we'll be back here on Marriage Conversation at WTBQ with Dr. Fu in just a few. WTBQ. Hello, and welcome back to Marriage Conversation. This is the show that happens here on WTBQ, the first Thursday of each month from 12 noon to 1 o'clock with Dr. Stephen Fru. Dr. Fru is a marriage coach and an author of two books on marriage, With These Rings and From Marginal to Magnificent. And you can go to his website, which is marriageconversation.com, which you can get through WTBQ on Shannon's Corner. And you can talk to Dr. Stephen Fru today. You can call us at 651-1110, or you can contact him and maybe Skype him or have a Skype conversation, right, Dr. Fru, as you mentioned, where you can actually do coaching, marriage coaching through Skype.
Yes, we do email coaching, we do phone coaching,
wonderful.
We do Skype coaching. We try to make it possible for people to get what they need, even if they're not in our local geographical area.
Right, and you're in California, so anybody who's listening on the radio in the car is definitely not in your geographical area, but we are certainly in your area to get coached by you. And we are talking about why your marriage needs to be a team. And if you're thinking, well, that's not romantic, actually, it is romantic in the fact that you're building your marriage stronger by having the vision that Dr. Fru was talking about before. You can build on it. And if that vision has been cracked, which Dr. Fru, most people go through a marriage, the vision's been cracked more than once, right? I mean,
I would actually say it a little differently. I'd say most people have never really realized that they had to create their vision consciously and intentionally with each other. Most of us haven't had much coaching and much help about how to have a healthy marriage. That's really what I've discovered over like the last 100 years of doing this work. I don't meet many couples who had good mentors, good elders, good people that were really teaching them. Look, if you're going to really, I mean, they had parents, but their parents' marriages were, you know, so-so, a lot of them. So it's a very small population of people out there in the United States that have had something good and are, you know, they know what they're doing and they're going for it. I want those people to be mentors to all the rest of us. But a lot of people, I would say 60 or 70% of all the marriages I've met, they've really not had much help. They got married, and everybody said, well, good luck.
Yeah.
And they were on their own to design it. Now, you need some help to design a good business, and you need some help to design a good team. You need some help to design a good marriage. That's just common sense for me.
Wow, that's really terrific. Now, you know, we should all go into a marriage like that, right? Because it would be so much more helpful. I mean, how much of this stuff that we're talking about, how much of this information about having a vision, being a partner, being a team, being, you know, finding your team leader, how much of this should we discern before we go into marriage?
Oh, I think we should have, if it was an ideal world, you know, I would say you should have a year or two of good, healthy, strong coaching before you actually decided to live together and go, because there's a lot of stuff. I like to tell clients, they say, well, what? How do you do this? And I say, you know, if a young man out here wants to get married, I like to ask him if he'll let me take him to breakfast some morning. And he'll say, yeah, I'll pick you up at about 7 o'clock. Yeah, wow, okay, I'll pick you up. So I pick him up, and I drive by the local preschool. And when we drive by the local preschool, we stop and we see these young mothers getting out of the car with their babies. Now, these young mothers, their hips are spread a little bit from just having a baby, and they're not having any makeup. They're in sweatpants or sweatshirts, and their hair is just stuck up with a barrette on top of their head and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're young mothers. They're like soldiers to me. They're doing what they need to do, you know? And I say, you see that woman right there? That's the woman you're marrying. And they look at me and say, what do you mean? I say, well, she's not sitting at a table in a fine restaurant with a candle between you with a push-up bra. She's not her. Now, when you're married to her, you'll have nights like the candlelight dinner night, but you'll have a lot of days that look and feel like that. She's working. She's doing a lot of stuff. She's paying bills. She's doing all kinds of stuff. And if you can't cherish and love her in this ordinary world, then you're going to have an awful, long, sorrowful relationship. Because a lot of what we bring to each other is ordinary life. You know, I work in the yard and I don't smell the best when I walk in. I don't shave on Saturday and I look like a bum or whatever. You know, that isn't the most romantic image for my wife to have me at 5 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon unshaven and smelling from working in the yard. You know, she doesn't say, oh my God, you're just so desirable. You know, and so we have to begin with conversations about what is it really like and what do we really hope for? What do we really desire? What do we really want to give? And how does that work? So that's coaching, because that comes from each person. Each person needs to be coached about their vision and what they bring to it. So if you look at a family, you have to say this. Every single person has their unique fingerprint. We know that. But every single person has their unique emotional and psychological and spiritual fingerprint as well. So each person, whether you have teenage children or little children, or whether your children are out of the house, each person, and of course the two partners, each bring a unique genius to relationship. If they've never noticed that, if nobody's ever helped them identify that, if nobody's made it explicit, what'll happen is that genius will be turned into something that's criticized and overridden. Oh, you talk too much, or you always want to do this, or whatever, instead of hearing what they're bringing. So my wife has a genius for attending to little things that can't take care of themselves, spiders and bugs and stuff. And all the grandchildren know this about her. That's Maga's spider. Don't you hurt that spider. So she has it. Now, that plays out in our relationship that she also has a high sensitivity to the things that are not being spoken. So I cut my leg badly the other day. I fell. And she was right in there. And I'm saying, that's okay. We'll just put it about it. I don't care about it. I was just being a dope. And she was saying, no, here's what we're going to do, And so she was leading there. She was taking care of something that I wouldn't know enough to take care of well. I didn't know enough to take care of well. So I have different genius. She has one genius, I have a different genius. So we have to learn about that and bring that into the conversation. Now, if you do that, then you start to get, this is a team conversation quickly before we run out of time. If you do that, then you start to know what you can be trusted for and what you can't be trusted for, what I can be trusted for and what I can't be trusted for. And we start to talk about that. Well, don't trust Stephen to be a good financial planner because he's not. He's not interested. So that doesn't make me bad, but that does give my partner heads up. Well, if he's not really interested in being a financial planner, somebody better be. And if she can't be, then let's hire somebody who is. But let's take care of our money in some way that's going to make us safe, right?
Mm-hmm.
So instead of her blaming me, you're just not a good financial planner, she says, you know what, Stephen, I'm not really that interested in financial planning either, so I think we ought to spend a small part of our budget on a financial planner who can help us be grown-ups.
So practicality comes in here very much, is really basically what you're saying. Instead of this romantic vision, a practical vision, one that really works on a daily basis. And romance can be a part of it, but it's not the whole picture. I think expectations are often what people get very caught up in a relationship. Many people I know who are going through a divorce or who are unhappy or, you know, or sometimes getting into a relationship are very they might not be unclear on their expectations, but they're very unrealistic. They expect the other person to change their life so much. And they expect so much from that other person that the expectations just, nobody can live up to those expectations. Is that part of the thing that we have to make realistic?
Well, I think that you're circling all the way back to the opening of the show, because I think the expectations come from our childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I think my father, for example, there's negative and positive expectations, right? In our case, my father taught his three sons, I told him at one point, to be emotionally stupid about women. Here's how he did it. Say, Dad, Mom's really angry. Oh, no, it's just that time of the month.
Mm.
So what we learned is to not relate to Mom when she was angry. We learned to name it something else. And that wasn't healthy for us in marriage, because we didn't listen to, all three of us had bad marriages, all three sons. We didn't know how to listen to women. We didn't know how to say, Shannon, you seem to be angry. You say, yeah, I'm angry. And I'd say, well, what's going on?
So
we didn't know how to do that.
So you're right. That goes back to the beginning of the show, that when we were talking about what we bring to the relationship by what was programmed into us by our parents. And if you start at the point, as you said, a behaviorist does, and lets all that go, now you have to be responsible for whatever your actions are in this marriage, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a start. That can be a starting point, at least in looking at a team and working from where you want to go. If you have to go back and pull out these things to examine them, fair enough. But if you want to make your marriage a team, you have to take it from the starting point now. Maybe get rid of blame as well.
Yes, absolutely. You have to look at a couple things. You have to, one, know what you can trust each other for, what you can't trust each other for. Know something about your partner's natural genius. Do a lot of conversation around that. Know what your expectations were coming in. Know what your vision is now. Know that how you want to expand that vision and where you need help. Know those things. But underneath all of this, there's a great, great quote from a book on a high school football team. I love this book a lot. I'll get the title. If anybody wants it, they can email me, and our email is...
Give us the quote, and we're going to end with your quote, because we got about 1 minute left.
Yeah, this is the quote. The coach looks at his team, and he says, "What's my job?" And the team shouts back in unison, "To love us." And then he says, "What's your job?" And the team shouts out, "To love each other."
Oh.
And now, that is a beautiful summary of what it's like to be a family. The parent's job is to love each other and everybody in the family. The children's job are to love each other. That's the job. That's what we need to do. That's how a high-performing team is built. That's the most important ingredient, and all the other things are competencies that we've been talking about today.
Okay. Until next month, when we come back with Marriage Conversation, everybody should work on their team and loving each other, because that's a great starting point, and we would love to hear next month how you're getting with that. Dr. Stephen Frew, as you know, we have to wrap it up for this month's Marriage Conversation. Go to marriageconversation.com, get a hold of Dr. Stephen Frew, and until next month, have a great marriage.
Your community radio station since 1969.
I'm Sherry Preston. It's being called the second largest Medicare scam in history.